You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News, but first this from KBOO. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Latin American Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. The next film in the series, Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, is showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. Dia de los Muertos follows Salma, a 16-year-old orphan who has never met her biological parents. Salma has spent most of her life searching out clues for her parents' identity. One day, she discovers a specific book and sets off on an adventure with her foster brothers to find the missing links to her family's heritage. Again, that's Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is having our annual book and record sale on November 23, 2019 to raise funds with support from the Willamette Week Give Guide. The sale will be located at Lagunitas Portland Community Room at 237 Northeast Broadway from 12 p.m. until 9 p.m. From classic books to coffee table books to cookbooks, treasures will be waiting for your discovery and just in time for the holidays. Enjoy community music, activities, and a live broadcast from KBOO at the event. Proceeds from the sales will support the station's operations. Right now, KBOO is accepting used books and records in good condition. Now through Friday, November 15th, listeners, members, and supporters can drop off donations during business hours at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. After hours, appointments can be made available. For more information, please call 503-231-8032 or go online to kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, tightening down on Portland streets as more scooters roll in.
A group known as Dadvocates are storming the nation's capital, saying the U.S. needs to help families deal with a child care crisis.
And KBOO takes a closer look at why millions are protesting in the streets of Chile.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Annette Newell. Scary moments this morning at several Kaiser schools. Police rushed out to McNary High School after a text came in about a teenage male running through the parking lot with a bat and a small rifle, wearing dark clothes, a hoodie, and a backpack. Three schools went on lockdown: McNary High School, Kaiser Elementary, and Cummings Elementary. Police did not find any suspect.
The school boards approved a policy of clear boundaries for student-teacher interactions. That's to prevent abuse in Portland's public schools. The professional conduct between staff and students policy includes guidelines for everything from a teacher's use of social media and email to what's acceptable conversation and physical contact. It seeks to prohibit adult staff's physical contact with students unless necessary for educational purposes such as band instruction or helping disabled students. Other policies include teachers and staff not being allowed to use personal vehicles to transport students for any reason other than an emergency. All email from employees to students must be through a PPS email address, and one-on-one meetings with students should be in open public spaces or rooms visible to others. There are exceptions for sensitive issues and counseling. The policy is a response to fallout from Mitch Whitehurst, a PPS teacher who kept his job and skirted discipline despite complaints complaints from students about inappropriate behavior.
Since Friday, social unrest has been mounting in Chile, with millions nationwide protesting in the streets. The military has started curfews throughout the country, and the official death toll there has reached 18. KBOO's Althea Billings takes a closer look.
Civil unrest has ruled the streets of Chile for about 8 days now, sparked by a recent hike in subway fares in Santiago. Freelance journalist Josh Tucker is located in Chile, and he says it isn't just about paying 30 extra pesos.
The fact is that a lot of the poorest people in the country, about 40%, spend a third of their income just on public transportation. So even a 30 peso rise, which is relatively small in the price of the subway, was enough to really make their lives a lot harder, especially coming on the heels of another raise just 2 weeks before. So last week, throughout the week, people were evading paying the subway fare. They were just jumping the turnstiles and getting on the trains. And so that went on through Friday. So the subway fare increase was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. On Friday night, there were also a number of violent protests. The subway stations were attacked. A total of 19 subway stations had significant fire damage. 6 Walmarts had significant fire damage. A 20-story international gas company building belonging to Enel also had significant fire damage. And so this is the crucial context for what brought now millions of people nationwide into the streets. The military was called out Saturday in response to all this fire damage, and President Sebastian Piñera called a state of emergency, which allows him to suspend a lot of people's basic rights, like the right to assemble. And so about half the country is under state of emergency, and many of those cities are also under a military curfew, which has become a shoot-to-kill curfew. In many cases, there are a lot of videos that have gone viral on the internet of the military opening fire on the streets, and the death toll since Friday is officially confirmed at 18.
Unions across the country started a general strike yesterday, including teachers, miners, and longshoremen, and plan to strike again tomorrow. Tucker says protesters are pressing President Sebastian Piñera to resign.
Even before this happened, President Sebastian Piñera has had approval ratings in the mid-30s. He's not a popular president. His agenda has been stalled. And he's a conservative billionaire, which is very out of step with the social demands that people have been making. This thing has been sort of a train wreck for him from beginning to end. So first, Friday night, as things started to intensify, members of the Chilean press found him in an Italian restaurant eating pizza, sort of in a wealthy area of town, while the country was responding to a crisis. So that threw him off kilter from the beginning. And then he declared the state of emergency and called out the military. The majority of the population is absolutely fed up with Piñera. For one moment, the Renuncia Piñera hashtag was the number one trending hashtag in the world. That, of course, means resign, Piñera.
Piñera made remarks Sunday, saying that Chile is at war, and for the older generation of Chileans, that reminds them of the 17-year-long reign of the dictator Augusto Pinochet. Pinochet was installed in a CIA-backed coup in 1973, and with him came extreme neoliberal economic policies. In Chile, highways and the water supply are privatized, unlike anywhere else in the world. This means that although Chile has seen economic growth in the past 10 years, little of that prosperity has been passed on to the average person. Economic inequality runs rampant in Chile.
I think that if you have a bad job, or if you're not sure about the security of your job, that's going to affect your health. And so the fact that the minimum wage in Chile being well under $500 a month, that's what 40% of Chileans live on, does not leave you enough to pay the bills. It's like, you can't live on that. And so every little way that the government tries to take money away, whether it's charging parents money to send their kids to high school. Many of the charter schools in Chile, parents have to pay tuition, or whether it's increasing the subway fare, or the privatized health system, or the privatized highways, or the privatized water system. All these things chip away at that already insufficient minimum wage that people are already trying to survive on. So when this conservative billionaire president does things that demonstrate that, or maybe people feel that he doesn't understand the really difficult situation they're in, like not raising the subway fare twice in a period of 3 weeks, and then triggers memories of living under dictatorship by calling out the military on his own people, people are incredibly inspired to be in the streets. And we're seeing just absolutely humongous crowds. You know, I've been covering protests here, like I said, for over 4 years, making my new documentary about social movements and indigenous rights actions in Chile called Veins of Resistance. That's veinsofresistance.net. And I got to say, I've never seen a five-day period where we had 5,400 people arrested in protest.
An extended version of my conversation with freelance journalist Josh Tucker can be heard tomorrow at 5:30 on the KBOO Evening News or online at kboo.fm. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
A controversial earthquake safety ordinance that pitted local building owners against the Portland City Council is likely to be overturned. The ordinance on the chopping block requires owners of the city's 1,600 unreinforced masonry buildings to put signs up telling people about the danger and include a warning in tenant rental agreements. This affects old brick buildings considered likely to collapse during an earthquake. Since Portland City Council voted it in back in October of 2018, the ordinance drew sharp criticism from groups including the NAACP, Portland Tenants United, and Music Portland. The groups say that the ordinance put an unfair burden on small business owners and historically black churches that cannot afford to reinforce their buildings.
A conference in Washington State is exploring how people can have a healthier relationship with death. Eric Tegedoff takes us to Seattle, where leaders of the alternative death movement are explaining how to reclaim the end of life.
Yes Magazine is hosting A Good Death, bringing together local and national figures who are thinking about and approaching death differently. Sarah Chavez is conference moderator and executive director of the Order of the Good Death, an organization that's healing the disconnect between families and the funeral experience. She says Seattle has become the epicenter for people working toward reimagining death care.
You'll get to meet a lot of these major players that are really at the forefront of helping people have a healthier relationship with death, protecting our death rights and care, and providing different, more eco-friendly and cost-effective options.
Chavez's panel includes Jeff Jorgensen, owner of Bellevue-based Green Funeral Home, Elemental Cremation and Burial, Yes Magazine contributor Cynthia Greenlee, who has written about death doulas, and Seattle's co-op funeral home of People's Memorial. This year, the Washington legislature passed a law that allows people to compost their remains. Katrina Spade, panel guest and founder of Recompose, says it makes the state the most progressive in the nation on death care. Recompose is pioneering the method for turning human remains into soil. Spade says the process mimics nature, much like what would happen to a body left in the forest. The sustainable process sequesters about a cubic yard of carbon in the soil, avoiding emissions from cremation or burial.
I started this work because I realized that whether you choose conventional burial or cremation, the last gesture you'll make on this planet will pollute. And I thought that that just seemed awfully disappointing.
Chavez says the medical and funeral industries established the current practices for the end of life more than a century ago, and it's been industry-led ever since instead of human-centered, and with little room for family involvement.
Even though we prepare for things like graduations, for having a baby, we educate ourselves about these huge life milestones, preparation for death is so neglected that we really have become this death and grief illiterate society.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Portland Bureau of Transportation, Disability Rights Oregon, and Lime Scooters have teamed up to make sure scooter riders understand how they are affecting others. The groups want riders to stop scooting on sidewalks and also to stop parking them across sidewalks and curb ramps. Both of those things are against the law in Portland, by the way. They also pose hazards for people with disabilities and all pedestrians. When the city first rolled out its e-scooter pilot program last year, Disability Rights Oregon took hundreds of complaints. When the group learned the city planned a second pilot program, they expressed their concerns. The legal director for Disability Rights Oregon, Emily Cooper, said, quote, "Our primary concern is safety. We really think if users understood what was at stake by riding on the sidewalk or parking poorly, they would understand and stop doing it." Portland Bureau of Transportation staff can take photos and write down scooters' ID numbers, dates, times, and locations, then work with e-scooter companies to issue warnings and fines. Transportation officials say they have already issued more than 500 warnings and penalties since April of this year. In Portland, you are supposed to ride e-scooters in the street or in bike lanes only.
TriMet's increasing its fare enforcement on the transit system. New fare inspectors and a new enforcement strategy began rolling out this week. 9 new fare inspectors started their field training on Monday. Riders can see them out on the system and can expect to have their fare checked. Once they're fully trained, TriMet plans to have the fare inspectors break into teams of 2 and do random fare inspections on trains and buses, plus at stations and transit centers.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden wants to overturn the Trump administration's regulations that limit tax credits for charities. He says they're hurting hospitals, child care, environmental, and other charity efforts across the country. Here's part of what he had to say on the Senate floor about the impact of the 2017 Republican tax changes.
This was a law that was half-baked, rushed to shovel hundreds of billions of dollars to those at the top of the economic pyramid in our country. Then $1.5 trillion was borrowed so that Donald Trump and his Republican allies could find a way to cover this tax cut for cronies and donors. Then, because they still needed revenue, Republicans deliberately targeted middle-class homeowners in states like New Jersey, New York, Maryland, and Oregon for tax increases. For some communities in Oregon, it's not uncommon for property tax bills alone for middle-class folks to exceed $10,000. But when our Republican colleagues took this flawed approach, they didn't want on the SALT issue to listen to experts. So the Trump Treasury Department stepped in, and without any clear authority to do so, the Treasury Department reversed a long-standing IRS provision that had allowed taxpayers a full deduction for charitable contributions to state tax credit programs. In essence, the Treasury Department created a new rule that extended the $10,000 cap on state and local tax deductions to also include charitable contributions to state tax credit programs. To make matters worse, because Republican senators began to see what an absurd approach this was, Secretary Mnuchin put together another carve-out for Republican interests, trying to figure out how to manage this flawed regulation. So, in effect, private school voucher programs would be exempt from the regulations. Middle-class families pay more, businesses pay less. That is the Republican way.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, who, along with New York Senator Chuck Schumer, has introduced a bill to overturn the so-called SALT limits of $10,000 on deductions, which they say are harming charities.
Pacific Northwest passenger train fans, listen up. They're gathering in La Grande, Oregon this Saturday to drum up support to bring back part of a long-ago canceled Amtrak route. It's called the Pioneer. It went from Seattle to Portland, then through the Columbia River Gorge to Boise, and then to Salt Lake City with a connection to Chicago. The volunteer-led nonprofit, the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, proposes to revive at least the Portland to Boise segment. Its president, John Nuxall, says the Eastern Oregon Rail Summit his group is hosting Saturday will kick off a long-term project. The Amtrak pioneer route through eastern Oregon and southern Idaho was a money loser for many years, though, before Amtrak canceled it in 1997.
A group calling themselves Dadvocates from around the country are in Washington, D.C. this week. Suzanne Potter explains they're meeting with lawmakers to press for federal paid family leave.
Right now, when a child is born or a family member is sick, in most states, companies do not have to grant extended paid time off. Robert Skaggs has four kids, including a young daughter fighting cancer and an infant son with heart defects. He says parents must be able to afford to spend those critical weeks with their loved ones.
That time of transition is absolutely critical for parents to be there, fathers and mothers, and there's no substitute for your presence.
Skaggs' employer gave him unpaid time off. While in the nation's capital, the group will deliver petitions with 36,000 signatures asking Congress to make family leave legislation a priority. California is one of seven states that offers partial salary replacement with paid family leave, but millions, including those working in the gig economy, are not eligible. Salvador Guillermo is a father of two who works as an independent contractor, so he was not able to take advantage of the state family leave program and ended up taking time off unpaid.
I wouldn't want to see anybody else go through what I went through as far as not being able to pay your bills, not having that income coming because you chose to be with your family.
Nationwide, 114 million people have no access to paid family leave. Out of 193 countries in the United Nations, only a small handful do not have national paid parental leave laws. New Guinea, Suriname, a few South Pacific Island nations, and the United States. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Tomorrow you're going to see purple on full display, and that's because October 24th is Domestic Violence Awareness Day. Local activists and their allies are planning to wear purple to highlight the problem that affects more than 28,000 Portlanders every single year. You can also support survivors of domestic violence tomorrow by eating at DeNicola's Pacific Pie Company or one of the many other restaurants that are donating their proceeds to the local nonprofit Call to Safety.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Culture in Motion. At 6 o'clock, it is The Underground. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, we've got a few clouds around, down to a low of 43. Tomorrow, we're looking at sunny skies again with a high of 68. Should be a beautiful day. Today in history, on this date in 1952, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was awarded to Ukrainian-born microbiologist Selman Waksman for his discovery of a treatment for tuberculosis. The quote of the day is from Waksman, who said, quote, "From the moment he is born to the moment he dies, man is subject to the activities of numerous microbes."
Facebook says it blocked four networks of social media accounts to prevent election interference. And one Democratic presidential candidate announces he might not have enough cash on hand to keep his campaign going. Here's more on the 2020 election from Lily Bulkey.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
I think the internet is becoming a wild and dangerous place right now, and we rely on it for so much of our civil discourse these days, and it's becoming more and more vulnerable.
The concern that University of Iowa computer science professor Douglas Jones has about the potentially negative impact of the internet on the election process is widely shared. Facebook this week shut down four networks of accounts, pages, and groups for what they call coordinated inauthentic behavior, attempting to influence the 2020 election. Three of the networks originated from Iran and one from Russia. Given America's historic antipathy towards monopolies, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has said that breaking up big technology would make election interference more likely. The U.S. is behind the European Union on privacy protections and other attempts to bring safeguards to big tech platforms.
Right now, we treat them functionally as a utility, when in reality, they're more akin to a publisher. They curate the content that we see. We would allow no publisher to do what Facebook is doing.
That was presidential candidate and former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke reacting to Facebook's standard advertising policy, which exempts ads for politicians from third-party fact-checking required of most other accounts. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren highlighted the dangers with her purposefully misleading Facebook ad last week. Reacting to Warren's call to break up big tech, here's O'Rourke.
We will be unafraid to break up big businesses if we have to do that, but I don't think it is the role of a president or a candidate for the presidency to specifically call out which companies will be broken up.
As campaigns rely more and more on social media for grassroots fundraising, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro is following New Jersey Senator Cory Booker's example from last month, letting supporters know on Twitter that he may drop out if he doesn't reach his goal.
We've reached a critical moment in this campaign. We need to raise $800,000 in the next 10 days by the end of October 31st in order to keep going in this race.
Castro, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, has about $600,000 on hand. But the top three Democratic fundraisers, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Warren, and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, all have over $20 million. President Donald Trump, though, has more than any candidate of either party, with over $92 million. The Center's Brendan Quinn says that's partly because Republican donors have just one major option.
There are a couple of challengers for the Republican nomination, but he's the incumbent and he's the biggest, strongest presence, whereas there are 20-plus options for Democratic donors to give to. While they are perfectly entitled to, and some are giving to multiple, if not all, of the Democratic candidates, their loyalty is going to be split.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
Time for an impeachment update. Today, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, Laura Cooper, testified behind closed doors. That came as a group of conservative Republicans stormed the proceedings in protest. They were not on the three committees leading the impeachment inquiry, so they were not allowed in today's testimony. Yesterday, Bill Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, testified that he was told President Trump would withhold military aid to that country until it publicly declared Ukraine was launching an investigation that could help Trump's re-election chances.
A new report makes a compelling case that the oil industry was aware of the effects of fossil fuel on climate change, but deceived the public about it for decades. As Diane Bernard reports, the first ever congressional hearing on big oil's history of climate denial started today.
Led by Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin and co-chaired by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, both Democrats, the investigation aims to show that more than 40 years ago, oil industry research proved that burning fossil fuels harms the environment, but that oil companies, including ExxonMobil, misled the public about those results to keep profits up, and they maintained a multi-million dollar publicity campaign to undermine the science, according to Richard Wiles with the Center for Climate Integrity.
They know they're making a product that's going to cause big problems. They do it anyway. They lie about it. And then in the end, with climate, they want the public to pay for all of the damages and all of the adaptation and preparedness that we're going to need to do for climate change.
ExxonMobil has said it hasn't done anything wrong, and its officials have dismissed reports of its climate denial as the work of anti-fossil fuel activists. The hearing starts the day after ExxonMobil went on trial in New York for securities fraud and for minimizing global warming risks to investors. And it comes 2 days after a new report called America Misled offers new details comparing oil industry deception about climate change to the tobacco industry's cover-up of the health effects of smoking. Wiley says another issue is how people of color and low-income communities are hit hardest by global warming.
People that have suffered the most from the damages from any of the climate-juiced hurricanes, it's always the poor communities that are left behind, and this isn't going to be any different. So it's a really serious problem that we're going to have to address.
He says the hearing aims to hold big oil accountable and that the industry's rejection of climate science prevented governments from taking action to avoid what is now widely considered a worldwide crisis. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard reporting.
Fossil evidence from 66 million years ago is showing that ocean acidification can cause mass extinctions. This research in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences looked at seashells from shortly after a giant meteorite hit the Earth, wiping out the dinosaurs and three-quarters of marine life. Chemical analysis of the shells showed a sharp drop in the pH of oceans in that century and up to the millennium after the strike. This spike demonstrated it was the meteorite's impact that made the ocean more acidic, dissolving the shells of many species. The ocean's the oceans acidified because the impact vaporized rocks containing sulfates and carbonates, causing acids to rain down. This mass die-off of plants on land after the strike also increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Scientists estimate that the current pH of the ocean will drop by the end of this century if carbon emissions are not stopped or if global temperature rise is not limited.
In Kansas this week, the Haskell Indian Nations University is holding an assembly on just transitions. Just transitions is a phrase that refers to moving away from industries that harm the environment, health, and workers. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Haskell Indian Nations University is hosting the Indigenous Environmental Network's Just Transition Assembly this week in Lawrence, Kansas. The term just transition is used by environmental groups to address industries they say harm the planet, health, and workers. Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, Tom Goldtooth, says the group has been working since the 1990s after seeing a lack of consultation on issues relating to Indian country.
There is no one watching the shop as far as advising tribal leadership on environmental protection and environmental health issues, those issues that are very critical to state governments where they have environmental infrastructure. But why was it in Indian country to where that wasn't even adequately addressed? So that was a time when I got involved by a lot of the communities that came together on this environmental justice issue, which was a lot of grassroots people.
Goldtooth says the group hopes to develop a toolkit and curriculum to be used by schools on different issues impacting Indian country. He says cuts to federal funding has awakened many tribal leaders.
I think it's a very timely topic, a very timely issue with the change in climate. And we really don't know where America is going in the next 50 years. Capitalism, those of us that have really have studied and looked at capitalism, and if capitalism fails, the whole economic system fails, where are we going to be at as indigenous, as tribal nations and our communities?
The conference is also focusing on missing and murdered indigenous women and food sovereignty. It continues through Friday. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., says his tribe is seeking the support of Indian country as the tribe asserts its treaty right to have a delegate in the United States Congress. The Oklahoma tribe is early in the process, but Hoskin says it's a key issue, not just for the Cherokee Nation, but all tribes.
If the United States breaks its promise to one of us, it's broken its promise to all of us. And if the United States will keep its word under any treaty, then I think we're all stronger for it.
That's the message Hoskin is sharing this week at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention taking place in Albuquerque, New Mexico.